For environmentalists, the last few years have been a series of bad defeats, but underneath and largely unnoticed, there is one big good thing happening, and that's the rapid rise of power from the sun. The cost of alternative energy has fallen below the price of fossil fuels. Now around the world, every 18 hours, people install solar panels equivalent to a coal-fired power plant. This is faster than any energy transition in history, and it may, according to our next guest, be the only remaining chance to slow down the rapid heating of the Earth. Bill McKibben is a dear friend to this program and to myself. He is the author of the brand new book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. The book is published by Norton. And it's always a delight to welcome Bill McKibben back to the roundtable. How are you, sir?
Joe, I'm great, and there's nobody I would rather be talking to you about this or anything else. What a pleasure to get to join you again.
Thank you very, very much. It's always good to talk to you. I spoke to you a few weeks ago about this book, and we were talking about sort of what was going on in the world, and that'll depress you. But what's interesting is that you saw this a while ago, obviously, in working on this book, of what, given the radical changes that we've seen over the last, let's say, year, even less than, that still gives you great hope in the sun.
Yeah, it is a very weird moment for me. I've spent my life often bringing people bad news. I wrote the first book about what we now call climate change, what we then called the greenhouse effect back in the 1980s. And I'm afraid that the warnings of that book have now come true. We see them every day around us in the flood and the fire and the discombobulation of our planet. And for me, it's the darkest moment of my life as an American. It feels to me like our democracy is flickering and faltering in ways that sadden me and anger me as much as I more than I can say. So it's very strange that in the middle of all that, there is one big good thing happening on this planet, so big and so good that it could conceivably take a bite out of not only that climate crisis, but also maybe that crisis of authoritarianism. And that big good thing is the very sudden, last 36 months or so, surge, spike, explosion in the use of renewable energy from the sun and the wind around this planet. The numbers in that surge are really astonishing. I mean, May was the last month for which we have numbered good data. And in May in China, they were putting up 3 gigawatts of solar power a day. A gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a large coal-fired power plant. They were building one of those out of solar panels every 8 hours. So we've really never seen anything quite like this. And if we really embraced it and got behind it all over, then a different world is still kind of a possibility.
Given, I want to focus on that part of embracing it. So given that, you just looking at the headlines in the past few days of such opposition to wind, What gives us any hope that there is going to be an embrace to the sun?
Well, so first of all, the U.S. is the absolute exception to the rule now in this world. The other countries of the world are moving at different speeds, but all in this same direction. China in the lead. China's become the world's first electro state, not petro state, but electro state. And its influence and its technology is spreading across the developing world at lightning speed. Even in this country, remarkable things are happening. California, which has adopted more renewable energy than any other state, hit a tipping point sometime in the last 10 months. California now, most days, produces more than 100% of the power it uses from renewable sources. At night, when the sun goes down, the biggest source of supply on the California grid are batteries that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon. That means that California is using 40% less natural gas to produce electricity than it was 2 years ago. 40% fall in fossil fuel use to produce electricity in 2 years in the fourth largest economy in the world is maybe the most hopeful statistic I've heard in all the years I've been working on this, especially since California is now being outpaced by Texas at the rate at which it's putting up clean energy.
So what can we learn from Texas? What is it? Because that seems to be the microcosm, right? I mean, what can we learn from Texas that can be then replicated throughout the country?
Texas, when developers come with a solar farm or a wind farm or something, utilities essentially have to connect them up to the grid right away. They have no choice under Texas regulation to do that. Around the rest of the country, utilities stall and drag their feet, and we have what's called the interconnection queue, and things can take forever. It's all a kind of game. And it's weird that Texas is the one place where that's not the case, since Texas is also the headquarters of the world hydrocarbon industry. But the economics are just so compelling. Texas, as you recall, had brownouts and blackouts a few years ago. And this summer, the head of the Energy Reliability Council of Texas, their grid regulator, said, that's not going to happen anymore in Texas. We've got enough renewable energy and enough batteries on the grid now that we have a fundamentally stable electric grid. So, you know, when the hydrocarbon industry, when the fossil fuel industry tried to change the law in Texas this spring, when they tried to make it more difficult to continue doing renewable energy, Texans, especially rural Texans, emerged from the woodwork to say, don't do this. This is how we pay the school taxes in our town. This is what keeps our old folks' home open. Don't do this. And the legislature backed away and didn't do it. Sadly, they had much more luck, big oil, with the U.S. Congress, which did do it and got rid of the incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act and empowered Donald Trump, who's now behaving in ways that I think can only be described as kind of mad king behavior. You know, we had a wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island that was 80% complete, and he just told them to stop work on it. Apparently, he's going to do the same thing this week with an almost finished wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts. We've never had anything like this in our country, and it's super sad to see since, among other things, this is where all this technology came from, Joe. I mean, the solar cell was invented in Edison, New Jersey in 1954. The first commercial wind farm in the world was on Grandpa's Knob in Vermont, about 30 miles south of my house and square in the middle of the WAMC listening area. So the fact that we're just handing the future over to the Chinese is particularly sad.
Bill McKibben is our guest. The name of the new book is Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. It is, when you talk about the history, I mean, I just remember growing up and hearing, you know, nearly 50 years ago that we were putting solar panels on the White House. What happened to solar and then ultimately its resurgence? Because had we stayed the course initially, we would be in a far different place, right?
Would we ever? So, yeah, first go around is the 1970s and the energy crisis. And Jimmy Carter, engineer president, understands that this is the way out. Puts solar panels on the roof of the White House. And more importantly, puts in his 1980 budget enough research and development money to, in his words, make sure that the U.S. was deriving 20% of its power from solar by the year 2000. Had we done that, the world would be literally a different place, among other things, not nearly as warm as it is at the moment. We didn't do that. Jimmy Carter got beaten. Ronald Reagan took down the solar panels from the White House roof and embarked us on a whole drill, drill, drill kind of thing that continues through his successor, Mr. Trump. The next great moment in this story comes not from the U.S., comes from Germany, where the Green Party, at around the turn of the century, held the balance of power in their legislative system. And they used that balance of power to demand what the Germans call the Energiewende, the energy transition. The German government agreed to pay lots of money to Germans who put solar panels on their roof. This was expensive, but that was what created the demand that allowed the Chinese to start getting very good at building low-cost solar panels. They got better and better. About 5 years ago, we passed some invisible line where power from the sun and wind became cheaper than power from coal and oil and gas. And that is why we are where we are now, on a planet where the cheapest way to make energy is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. That is an epochal moment for humans and potentially a deeply liberating one.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about this, too, is there was an attempt even in the last administration with incentives and so forth. Well, those are all gone. So does that matter? I mean, do we need incentives or can we just scare the hell out of people?
Yep, we need incentives in the short run, but we're not going to get them. We have no power to influence Congress at the moment. And so instead, what we can do is make it much, much easier at the state and local level to build out solar and wind power. We're doing this big Sunday thing on Sunday, September 21st. Not Earth Day, but Sunday, a nationwide celebration of renewable energy. There'll be remarkable things across your listening area. People can go to sunday.earth and find out all the events that are being planned, but there's some great ones, including this relay from up in the northern Adirondacks down to Albany that should be really fun and interesting. And a lot of it's being organized by all sorts of people, but the Upstate New York chapter of Third Act is doing a fantastic job in all of this. One of the goals is to press state and local leaders to make it much easier to put this stuff up on your roof. It costs a third as much, literally a third as much, to put solar panels on your roof in Australia or the EU as it does in the US. A tiny fraction of that's due to the tariffs and the cost of the panels, but most of it's due to the Byzantine system we have, where 15,000 municipalities in this country each have their own building code and their own team of inspectors and so on and so forth. It can take months to get solar panels up on your roof, where it takes days, literally a couple of days in most of the rest of the world. We can change this by using technology like the Solar App Plus developed by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory that allows contractors to get an instantaneous permit as soon as they show that the equipment they want to install is compatible with the grid in the area where they're going to install it. New Jersey, Maryland, and California have mandated its use. It's time for that to happen elsewhere. It really is time for New York State to get on the stick here and be moving more quickly. We have a good set of enabling laws, but at the moment, the Hochul administration's not really stepping up to the plate and moving with much speed here. So time for that to happen, and that's one of the things we'll be demanding on Sunday.
I heard a rumbling, a deep guttural rumbling in the force field a few weeks ago when I heard the governor of New York State talk about nuclear power, and I think it was coming from you. So how counterintuitive is it to be trying to push and to work on an agenda regarding sun when suddenly, of all things, nuclear power is being embraced?
So I don't think most people have huge problems with nuclear power qua nuclear power. Like, yes, there are big risks, and we know what they are compared to the risks of overheating the planet, they're, perhaps manageable. The real risk, though, what the governor is proposing is just the opportunity cost. Nuclear power is so expensive and slow that that time and money and attention could be so much more easily spent on producing solar and wind power, and we'd get 10 times as much. I mean, under state law, the state government's supposed to be coming up with 15 gigawatts of clean energy in the next few years. That nuclear power plant would be about 1 gigawatt, and it would cost as much as doing the other 14 gigawatts of sun and wind. So the key here is to take the technology that we have on the shelf. I think sometimes, Joe, that people have gotten, we've called it sun and wind alternative energy for so long that that's gotten stuck in our heads. And we think of this stuff as the whole foods of energy. It's nice, but it's pretty pricey. It's not anymore. This is the Costco of energy. It's cheap. It's available in bulk. It's on the shelf, ready to go. So we should make use of it.
Chapter 7 of the book, Do We Have Enough Land? I found this chapter especially interesting because you talk about this choice often between producing crops and producing energy, and obviously this is something that can be, in your opinion, rather easily solved.
Yes, absolutely. So the first thing to say is we already use huge amounts of our landscape for producing energy. Half the corn crop in America, 30 million acres worth of corn, is turned into ethanol. We're just growing gasoline, and it supplies about 3% of all the energy we use in this country. If you just took that same 30 million acres and covered them with solar panels, you would supply 100% of the energy that we use in this country. That's because solar panels are way more efficient than ethanol. In the book, I described being in a Illinois farm field last summer with a guy who was converting part of his farm. He was saying, "Look, here's a cornfield currently used for ethanol. That acre will produce enough ethanol in a year to drive my Ford F-150 pickup 25,000 miles. Here's an acre that I'm turned from corn into solar panels, and it will produce enough electrons to drive my Ford F-150 Lightning, the EV version of the same truck, not 25,000 miles, but 700,000 miles." Okay. And that second field with the solar panels on it, you don't have to make it work. You don't have to pour huge amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus on it to later wash into Lake Champlain and cause us huge problems. You don't have to strafe it with pesticides and herbicides. You instead can use the land in between the rows for what we're calling agrivoltaics. On an overheated planet, shade is a really valuable commodity. I was just looking at a study from France where wine growers were finding that grape yields grew 60% when they had their vines in fields with solar panels. So these are completely manageable things. In fact, they're sort of spurs to human creativity to figure out how to do things better.
There are stories, and I'm just interested in how we try to avoid this, but there are stories where solar companies will come into municipalities and say, "This is what we want to do." They are given the opportunity to do so, only to have that company sold about 17 times. And then eventually, 2 years later, there's a forest growing up between the solar panels. It's happened enough times that there are concerns in many areas that come in and that are somewhat leery then of the practice. I'm curious as to what you make of the companies doing this and how, and God forbid I use the word regulation, but what we do to make sure that is something that doesn't happen to these communities.
Yeah, what's happening now in solar fields across the country is that communities are requiring, and they should require, bonds from people building them to make sure that they're maintained and then that they can be dismantled at the end of their life. And that's now standard practice most places. Polling shows that most communities are actually delighted with the solar or wind installations in their communities, in large part because they supply big amounts of tax revenue to local communities. And that's something that, especially in rural America, has been in short supply in recent years.
The name of the new book is Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. Bill McKibben is going to be all over the place talking about the new book. First of all, he's going to be at the new Marlborough Meeting House on Saturday, September 13th at 4:30. And you can find out more about that by going to nmmeetinghouse.org. Then don't forget that Bill mentioned Sunday. Sunday is September 21st. And you can find out more about that and all the events associated with it by going to sunday.earth, sunday.earth. Finally, October 22nd at 6 p.m., Bill and I will be in discussion at Skidmore College to talk about the new book. It's Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. in an event for Northshire Bookstore. And you can find out more about that by going to northshire.com. You're a busy man, and I thank you very, very much for sharing with us today. I wish you luck spreading the word.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you for one more good chapter in our ongoing conversation. It means a lot to me.
And to me. Thank you very much. Be well. Again, the name of the new book is Here Comes the Sun. Bill McKibben at the new Marlborough Meeting House on Saturday, September 13th at 4:30. He'll be at Skidmore College in a Northshire Bookstore event in conversation with me on October 22nd at 6 p.m. Find out more at northshire.com. And yes, Sunday, S-U-N-D-A-Y, is on September 21st, and you can find out more by going to sunday.earth. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.